I try to bring that awareness too. My work is to try to leverage the things that I can for our frontline workers in such a way that their lives are better, that our patients' lives are better, and that we're enriched through that service.
Welcome to Flourishing in Medicine from Surviving to Thriving. I'm your host, Dr. Mick Krasner, and this podcast is produced by MPRO, a medical professional liability insurance carrier headquartered in New York State and committed through a number of peer support offerings to supporting the physicians they protect. Today, I'm really excited to share with you my conversation with Dr. Justin Klimaris, Vice President and Chief Clinical Officer for McLaren Health, a large integrated nonprofit healthcare delivery system in the state of Michigan. An oncologist by training, Dr. Klimaris' leadership involves overseeing the clinical operations of this complex healthcare delivery network with over 14 hospitals and over 700,000 covered lives in Michigan and Indiana. During this conversation, Dr. Klimaris discusses his leadership in McLaren Health, highlighting the organization's dedication to its medical staff, as well as to many diverse communities while not navigating financial constraints and significant public health challenges such as the Flint, Michigan water crisis, gun violence, and maternal health care delivery issues. He shares his vision for how large and complex healthcare systems can improve workforce stability and community engagement through fostering an environment where staff receive the support needed to excel in complex patient care delivery and to address social issues. He underscores and seems to live the importance of transparent, authentic, and engaged leadership, mindfulness, and personal connections alongside emergent technologies in driving changes that can help healthcare in the future. I found his candor, humor, genuineness, and warmth to be really comforting, and it helped me to better understand the connection we can all have with people who embody true leadership. And now my conversation with Dr. Justin Klimaris. Welcome, Dr. Klimaris, Flourishing in Medicine from Surviving to Thriving. And one of the reasons I'm really excited and wanted to have you on the podcast is this podcast is about flourishing in medicine. It's about helping physicians and other health professionals improve their well-being so they can do the work they do and maintain high quality. And interestingly enough, we've had people from different aspects and different domains of medicine. We've had academic leaders involved in peer support programs, such as Joe Shapiro from the Brigham. We've had people that are involved in medical student, undergraduate medical education, looking at the antecedents of well-being or burnout, let's say it's opposite, and seeing what medical education has to offer to address this issue. We've looked at the 10,000 foot level with people like Colin West from the Mayo Clinic, who really looks at the bigger issues and what's going on here. But for you as a leader of a health system, a very large health system that has a lot of complicated moving parts, it's going to be really interesting because you have both a service mission, an educational mission, a community mission. You have many, many missions. So thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Wonderful. What I'd like to start with is, and I start with all my guests on the program, I like to hear a little bit about you, mostly if you can focus your comments about why medicine for you. What was the calling, if there was a calling, if you saw it that way? What was the draw? Were there some experiences you could share that you had in your formative years, either very young or even in your educational years, that really moved you in this direction that has confirmed this choice of career, which I would like to say it's a calling for many of us. And I'd also like to say that it's not easy. I think we know that. And so there's something about it that keeps us in it, that moves us toward it. And it would be really interesting to hear your story.
Thank you, Mick. I'm so happy to be on the program as well and have been so touched by many of your previous guests and the powerful messages that have come out of the discussions you've had with them. I, like you, believe medicine and many, many careers that we might choose in our lives are indeed callings. I think that I felt that at from a very young age. I grew up in a small rural community in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, in fact, an island, you know, thinking of the no man is an island unto himself. You know, we were very aware in small rural northern Michigan that community was really important and that individuals in that community depended upon one another. I wasn't quite sure from a young boy what exactly I would do, but I knew that I wanted it to be, I wanted my career to be related to service. I loved school and loved learning. And early on in elementary school, I remember the American Heart Association sent me a medical illustration of the Frank Netter diagram of the heart. And I remember opening that envelope and thinking that that message had been sent directly to me and how fascinating it was and words that I couldn't understand from Latin and the structure of the heart. And that triggered for me an idea that I would think about becoming a physician. And it really followed me through my younger years, including a lot of very formative experiences with mentors that helped guide me and also believed that this fourth or fifth grade student knew something about what he might want to do and took me seriously.
That's fascinating that the image itself would call on. Actually, we sometimes think of it as imagination, our imagination, imagining our future. And the word, of course, you know, comes from image, taking an image and then projecting that into something that could be. And was there, you know, an aesthetic quality to what you saw in those drawings? Because I remember being touched by the Frank Netter drawings as a medical student and thinking, oh, how I would love to have a full set of the Netter, of all the Netter books, you know, on my shelf one day in the future as I become a successful physician or something like that. Was it the aesthetic? Was it something about heart itself, you know, something beyond the picture of the heart, but what it really meant to you? You know, just maybe you can say a little bit more about that because I'm curious.
A fascinating question, and I've actually never thought of it as sort of that the image happened to be the heart and what that might mean. For me, there was certainly a sense of wonderment that this is the thing that we think gives life itself, right? Where it's the one thing in our bodies, we can feel our pulse, we can place our hand on our chest and feel the heart beating beneath us and be aware of our vitality itself. So there was something, I imagine, you know, very powerful about that itself. But for me, in terms of a driver, it was much more, I was aware of the knowledge one would have to understand how that worked, to understand the structure of that organ. And I was mesmerized by the idea of being able to learn something as complex as the human heart or as complex as the whole body, much more magical, and to be able to have that be your life's work. Coupled with that, I was just very privileged to have some very kind physicians myself that not only cared for me, but cared for family members in our community, that I was able to see that drawing, that intense study that would be required to understand it, but also then connect that to a larger frame, which was this individual who very much was a part of our life and shaping our life, our family physician. And I saw his work as so noble. And I saw the importance that he was the only physician on the island we lived on. So one can imagine, you know, the place that he had in our community. And it's one of the things as I reflect today and we think about the challenges that healthcare providers are facing across the, doesn't matter what job you have in a health system, the burnout, there was a nobility of the work that he did. And I connected with that. And it's also for me now commonplace that I look back to when times are tough. We have to remind ourselves of the importance of our work. And for me, that's a sort of a wellspring of maybe of imagination of and of hope of what I wanted the work to do, but also a very real example of the powerful work that I saw being done by a young physician in our community.
I also remember physicians that took care of me when I was a young child and the influence that had on me. And maybe you could talk a little bit about then, how did you, or in what way did you carry that sense of practical nobility, somebody doing something, but it was very practical. This was a very real, tangible thing that this family physician offered into your training and career path as it developed. Maybe walk us from that moment when you're committed to become a physician through the various ways you were trained to maybe a realization that the well-being of your colleagues and the larger healthcare service community was a really important part of your personal mission.
Great question. I think because there's a large span of distance, and as a 47-year-old, it just seems like yesterday, but lo and behold, that was many decades ago as that journey began. But certainly what I was aware of from my physician mentor at the time, and his name is Scott Aldridge, a wonderful, wonderful man. He's retired now, but was a sense of character, a sense of duty and service that did carry with me as I went through my journey in school, which is a long journey. I went to a medical school in Michigan that was very focused on providing care to all of the state with a mission to make sure that our rural communities and underserved communities like Drummond Island, where I grew up, and Flint, Michigan, where we're headquartered, that they had physicians. Went to the College of Human Medicine at Michigan State, and very, very humanistic, it's in its name, a very humanistic medical school. I thought I would be a primary care physician, but I fell in love with internal medicine and oncology specifically. I saw so much hope in my patients with cancer. I saw that not only was I able to apply cutting-edge science to the work as an oncologist, but I also had patients in front of me every day reminding me that there's so much more out there than my challenges. And if I came to work on a particular day and had problems with traffic and my log-on wouldn't work for my EMR, I only needed to see a patient for a minute to realize that those are all small problems. And so to me, that service of what kind of provider I wanted to be was shaped into the love of science and then that reminder from patients. And as I have sort of evolved through my career to help lead a cancer program in multiple states, and then now to serve as a chief clinical officer of a health system, I try to bring that awareness too. My work is to try to leverage the things that I can for our frontline workers in such a way that their lives are better, that our patients' lives are better, and that we're enriched through that service. I hope that that answers or speaks to it, but that's been sort of the evolution for me. You know, and I did do other things for a while. I went to a very academic oncology training program at Johns Hopkins, had envisioned myself being a clinical trialist, but I was very aware that that work, although critically important, I wanted to be much more about how we would organize care, how we would determine ways to deliver that care, especially back in my home state, which is why I find myself in the role that I'm in now.
I'd like you, if you could, to describe McLaren Health to them. I think there will be a lot of identification. Many of us work in large health systems, in large health system networks, and I think they may be able to relate to something as complicated as McLaren, especially from someone who came up as a clinician first before, you know, taking on the mantle of leader in that system. So if you could tell us a little bit about McLaren Health and then maybe move us into what are some of the major challenges that you in your position see that your rank and file medical staff are experiencing, you know, how do you stay in touch with that?
Sure. So McLaren Healthcare is a large integrated delivery network. We are, from a clinical perspective, based in Michigan. We have 14 acute care hospitals, about 30,000 employees. We have two health insurance plans, one in Indiana and one in the state of Michigan, where we cover about 800,000 covered lives, largely in a Medicaid HMO and Medicare Advantage population. We touch patients from the middle of the Upper Peninsula all the way to the Ohio border. From a clinical perspective, we own an NCI Comprehensive Cancer Center, the Carmanis Cancer Institute. It was the cancer program I referenced earlier. And that organization is one of 55 NCI-designated comprehensive cancer centers in the country. We touch one in three patients that are diagnosed with cancer in the state of Michigan. And our health system, really from the, in those geographies, oftentimes is the primary provider of care in those communities. We have many what would be considered traditional safety net hospitals, having a hospital in Flint, Michigan, and Pontiac, Michigan, and communities that can be that have all kinds of modern challenges, to very rural areas of the state where some of our providers might be the only, for instance, a gentleman I was speaking with a couple of weeks ago is the only pulmonologist in a 22 county area of the state. And so it's a very unique organization. We're about $6.5 billion in net revenue as an organization. We grew from a single hospital in Flint, Michigan. Relative to our medical staff and our providers, we try to be very cognizant at McLaren of the communities we serve and the places we're from, if you will. We very much have communities are very distinct, as I outlined, but we try very much to make sure that our mission in those communities is meeting the community need, is reflective of the communities we serve and the variety that's there. But increasingly, as many of your listeners may know, you know, in healthcare today, systems have to really organize themselves to deliver efficient, high-quality care. That doesn't happen on accident. And you know, the margins we struggle with in Michigan, you know, where many health systems are struggling for a 1-2% operating margin, that's a daily struggle and a daily challenge in our state. When we see the workforce shifts that we've seen with large vacancies and recruitment challenges, it's even more difficult to recruit to some of our very rural areas that we staff. So we have to constantly be aware of our workforce, aware of the needs of our community, true to our nonprofit service mission for those communities, true to the fact that in most of our communities, we're the number one employer in those areas. So the full ecosystem of challenges confronts us, right, in each of our markets. And so I, as someone in charge of our clinical programs in the health system, try to be as engaged as possible with our medical staff, visiting our hospitals, getting to the front line, thanking our teams for their service, for the work that they do every day, making sure that they have the right tools and instruments that they need to do their work. But increasingly, you know, today, as you question sort of the challenges of the time, how to inspire us to take a breath, recognize the challenge of the last 5 years, but also find within us a wellspring to continue to show up every day and work hard for our patient and for our communities. And that is, each day is a struggle, but I will also say that each day I meet people that are rising to that in ways that are awe-inspiring and so rewarding.
That's really, really great to hear. And the challenges are overwhelming in some ways, as you describe. And yet I think we're equally up for them collectively. And I think it does take the collective. It's not on any individual. Because you mentioned the communities, some of the communities, and because one of them in particular has garnered pretty significant national attention, maybe you can just give us a little bit of an impressionistic view of Flint, Michigan, and the community issues that have garnered that national attention and how it has impacted healthcare delivery and how your clinical staff, especially physicians, have had to kind of sort of pivot themselves in order to meet those challenges.
It is something that I think is in the very fabric of our company, and that our first hospital was in Flint, Michigan. And we see the challenge of the infrastructure of the city of Flint. You can see it in the highways and roads. We certainly, you know, tragically for the Flint water crisis that garnered national attention, saw just the real dangers of some of the decisions that can be made by our government officials that were made to try to shore up the economic resources of the community. In principle, for your listeners who may not know, decisions were made by emergency managers of the city to convert the water supply for the city of Flint from the Detroit water system, the Detroit River, to the local Flint water system, a system that hadn't been used for many years, if not decades. That led to a large amount of lead coming into the water supply. And for many community members, individuals who still have not had full water restored to their homes, we can easily take for granted shelter, water, food, those of us, the lives we live and are gainfully employed, et cetera. But I think in Flint, we realized that even with those things provided, there are issues related to public health and public infrastructure that must be met. I am very proud to say that Flint is also a success story and that we have seen an enormous amount of commitment to the city to get things fixed. The issues related to racism and poverty in the city are explored and are open more now than they probably have ever been. We still have clear economic challenges in the community. Yet I do think our local government, our state government has responded, and we're on our way again. But there is no doubt that when you go through an episode like that, when you go through, you know, a gun violence issue in our communities that most of us now have all gone through in one way or another, you realize that we're a part of a greater whole and that these issues around us don't escape us, that we do our work even in those very real challenges.
And the pandemic has really shown how the medical communities have actually lived up to their commitments to take care of their communities. And I think it is noble, as you said earlier. As a leader, I am curious, because there's so much about that when you were, say, working in the front lines that we're not aware of. Maybe you can just share, what are some of the things that you grapple with that many of your frontline people just, it's not so transparent to them, and it would be helpful for them to at least know and understand, because I think ultimately we all have to work together, and ultimately, actually every one of us is a leader in a certain way, especially as physicians. Even though you may not be, you know, you may not see yourself that way, you actually are. What are some of the things that, if you can think of some that are just not so clear to the rank and file, that would be helpful for them to know that the leaders are thinking about and struggling with and grappling with and have them in mind?
I think your very question, as I experience it, is something that I continuously trying to figure out the right way to convey. You know, I think it is easy for us to assume that Washington doesn't understand our problems, that our corporate office doesn't understand our problems, that they're holding back on us and maybe don't fully appreciate what it's like. Work every day with the same conviction that I came to when I was a medical student, when I was a resident, a fellow, a young attending physician, a young leader, or now someone who has been in healthcare administration, you know, for going on 2 decades. I come to it with the same commitment that I want to do right by my community, right by my patients. The things that I have to manage and the things that I need to be aware of are much more complex and are much more systemic now than they were when I was taking care of one patient at a time. But what I hope our frontline team understands, and I think they do when we trust our leaders and when our leaders are transparent and when we're communicative, understand that we have their backs, that we too are working diligently to solve some of the challenges. You know, what comes to mind today, and we're, I think, in many communities, if not nationally, starting to see finally some of the fruits of our work to mitigate healthcare disparities and to identify issues related to health equity. We are launching a massive maternal health campaign in our organization. And if we look at maternal health deserts, not only across Michigan, but across the country, you know, we're coming together as leaders to make sure we have the right tools and technology to reach out to patients, to care for patients properly, especially vulnerable patients in vulnerable communities. And then we're able to take that message of what the corporate investment is and what that leadership structure is, what those resources are, and use the full power of our health plan that has many Medicaid members. We are beginning to make inroads and connections with community service organizations, with faith-based institutions. And so I hope our communities, our providers are seeing that we at McLaren and we as healthcare systems are much more deeply engaged. And I think that the pandemic, our crisis, any of these large issues teach us is that we are all dependent upon one another. And I hope that our staff understand that we're committed to that and using our resources wisely to serve them.
What you described, this maternal health program that you're talking about seems really timely. I just listened to a podcast series. I don't know if you're familiar with The Nocturnist. It's out of the California Medical Association, but they did a podcast on maternal health in the post-Roe era. And, you know, just thinking about where Michigan is placed in the country and its bordering states, I'd imagine there are interstate demands and issues that are also part of what comes across the border and, you know, impacts the delivery and service network of McLaren. So I think those are really, really important things to address.
Yes. We were very aware in the state of Michigan, you know, regardless of one's policy view or religious view on the issue of access to reproductive health services, we as healthcare providers, of course, believe we have a duty to our patients. And certainly we were concerned in the early days. Michigan had what was referred to as a trigger law from the early 1900s that after the Dobbs decision, no longer being in place, that trigger law was set to be enacted in the state. And we were very concerned. We had to plan for that as a board, plan for that with our physicians and medical staff, thinking about the legal vulnerability, et cetera, and certainly the criticality of the care that our moms needed to receive. Certainly, God forbid, a pregnancy be in jeopardy, their life be in jeopardy, as we hear and see now. What we see after that, of course, is Michigan passed a law that allows for access to reproductive services as a state law. But we are seeing, being a border state, patients enter our communities from other states. And I think that adds an added pressure as well to our OBGYN physicians and to our providers more broadly. It certainly brought an awareness to how we safely provide care for our patients, but also respond, knowing that Michigan has lots of conservative areas that also might have a different view than the public health enterprise or the health delivery enterprise may have to engage.
Yeah, I appreciate you commenting on that and sharing that, because I think it is, those are really challenging public issues in the public discourse, much like the issues around the gun violence or the water quality in Flint, and without easy solutions, but we have to turn toward them as medical people. We live it. We can't, you know, we've taken an oath not to turn our back on what's right in front of us. So thank you. I want to just shift a little bit. Maybe this may be a little, I don't know, easier, maybe not the quite word that we've been sort of talking about, very pretty challenging issues, but this may be a little fun, I think. I want to do a little imagination exercise, and I'd like him to imagine that it's 5 years from now. And the issues that you've been struggling with in your health system environment, well-being of providers, nursing shortages, staff issues, et cetera, let's imagine that they've all improved to the point that the environment and the staff feel extremely strong, robust, energetic, creative, committed, and fully resourced to handle even the most complex patient care and even the most complex social issues. So I know it may be a bit of a stretch. imagine, and yeah, you'd probably be thinking to yourself, "Well, I won't have a job when that happens, right?" So, how would you feel as a leader yourself? What would that feeling be like if you're 5 years from now and you've been part of the system that has brought this about, that people are feeling that way? What would your leadership experience look like in that imaginary world?
That is a welcome diversion from its current existence, its current place. You know, what I would hope, and the first thing that came to mind, because I thought you might go in a little different direction with the question, is I'm fascinated by how medicine is going to change relative to generative AI and using machine learning and other technologies to know as much as we possibly can, whether we're a clinician trying to make a decision or we have sort of the panoply of experience that a patient had fully known and digestible in that encounter. What I hope we will get back to is the beauty of medicine. With all of the challenges that you described being lifted, we're able to be back in the room, back in with that, and to have presence. And presence is a beautiful thing. I think that probably is the greatest experiential threat to fulfillment and a trigger for burnout is that disconnection from that moment with our patient, that time to truly be present and not have 52 alerts go off on our EMR and a pager and not that those things won't still be there, but I do think that many of the challenges that do burn us out today, you describe a system in which those are gone. And I have, even experiences of losing patients and times where I was present for the death of a patient. I can remember the beauty of those moments as well. And I hope that's there. And I think that can be restorative.
All these issues, what they in effect do is they move the patient a little bit to the periphery when the patient is really at the center. And if we, when we're able to keep the patient at the center and when we're able to be present to that and engage in that, that's, the source of meaning, that's the source of well-being. And actually, it's also the source of completing our mission or fulfilling our mission. There's no completing of it because it's endless. But the fulfilling of the mission of being a physician, being in healthcare. I'm wondering, so let's say, we've gotten to that point 5 years from now in this imaginary world, and the patient is returned to the center where they need to be, and we see that and we're present to that. In those 5 years, what did you as a leader have to learn in order for that to happen? It's kind of like asking you, what's my learning plan in the next 5 years to kind of get from point A, where we are now, to point B? It can help us actually, and all our listeners, orient ourselves toward what could be possible and what are some of the steps we can do to move in that direction.
Good question. One of my first thoughts was an individual, a leader who I was able to have a couple of encounters with an undergraduate, Dr. Stephen Covey, who's wrote the very popular book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, and many other great books. But Stephen studied the behaviors and habits of highly effective people. And one of the habits that he talked about, habit number two, is to begin with the end in mind. And so really your question is, in 5 years, with that end in mind, what do we do to get ourselves there? And I sure hope, and I believe this to be true, that number one, there's an enormous transforming capability of young people to help us see things and show us a way that those of us who helped create these problems, we didn't have that wisdom when we created these problems, right? Or were present with them. We have allowed a medical documentation system in the form of the electronic health record to almost totally isolate the doctor-patient relationship to a keyboard and a computer screen at times when touch and connection are deeply meaningful and powerful and lead to resiliency, right? So I hope that we are going to listen to our young people. We're going to find and identify that we need greater balance, that we can only push people so far. We need to do our work more intelligently and more efficiently, effectively. We need to realize that health and wellness don't come from an enterprise that's just focused on traditional sick care or the delivery of treatment for illnesses and disease, but are transformational and developing clean water and developing good diet, nutrition, et cetera, that those things will ultimately also make the working in a health system more enjoyable. So while these things are disruptive and challenges now, I think we really do have freeing power ahead. A challenge that we also have to deal with, though, in the US, of course, is the rising cost of care and the notion that, costs more to receive care in the United States than anywhere in the developed world. And we're really not seeing outcomes that we need to see. So I think that, we will continue to see disruption affecting what now seems to be our equilibrium, but may itself end up being a transforming force to a better way in the future. And I'm an oncologist, so I'm always an optimist, just hardwired that way.
Lovely,
I hope
yeah.
that spoke.
I really also like your pointing out the youth and also bringing in the potential of these new technologies, machine learning, generative AI, that could actually, if used properly, could really free us up and help us do our work so we can actually not have to carry and possess all this knowledge, but understand how to use that knowledge and apply it in much more effective, efficient, and meaningful ways, both for our patients who receive our care, but also for ourselves who enjoy that whole enterprise of being a doctor, of being engaged with patients. We're almost done here. I wanted to just two things. The first is, I had mentioned this earlier about leadership. So understanding that each medical staff member is a leader in a certain way, and that the leadership, yourself and others at McLaren and other places, are made up of many folks who at one time were working on the front lines. And so understanding that, knowing that, is there a message you'd like those medical staff to understand from what you've learned as a leader that could help them right now, you know, feel a little bit more resourced, feel themselves like they actually, it may seem like they have very little control and a huge amount of responsibility, and that is true, but there may be small ways in which they can feel themselves part of a change that is needed.
I think, you know, that recognizing that everyone's part is critical to me has always been a part of my leadership philosophy, and frankly, just witnessing effective teams and how we effectively work together. For me, and for other leaders at McLaren, certainly having integrity and being true to our mission, even in challenging times, being mindful of the growing contribution that all team members make to that outcome is really important. At a personal level, for me, a changing experience in my life was learning a meditation practice and a mindfulness practice that I, when I'm doing it right, do every day. But even in when it's not 30 minutes or 20 minutes on the cushion in the morning, as I often do, it is simply just dropping in to an awareness of this moment as it is and accepting it and trying to bring presence to that moment and recognizing that not only does finding presence bring usually a calmer, more rational, more inclusive view of things, it also brings forward compassion and an understanding that it's all changing. And having awareness of that as a leader for me was a critical lesson. I didn't always have it. And now, today, if I'm in a board meeting and there's a challenging moment, I am sitting back in the chair and feeling my back on the seat. I'm feeling my legs on the floor, and I'm noticing my in-breath and my out-breath. And that moment alone can help me to recognize the things I mentioned. And so that's a personal element that I use.
No, that's a wonderful message to give, a practice to have, and something that really does can reset, help recalibrate ourselves, especially when we're feeling most likely to be thrown off, as you describe in that meeting. Okay, and just finally, what do you like to do to take care of yourself, to have fun? Just let's get a little sense of Justin Clamorous as a person. It may be the things that you're doing at work. Maybe that's how you get your most fun, but there may be other things in your life you want to share with our listeners. And then anything else you'd like to add to the podcast as well?
Sure. Well, thank you. You know, I think like so many of us, our friends and family are so important to me. The challenges of the pandemic, when we were isolated really from a lot of our friends and family, reminded me of that importance. But when I'm not working, that's a key priority for me. Of course, scheduling that and making sure as a busy executive that still remains a priority, and that I promise to be home to cook dinner tonight, and that I hold my end of the bargain. We have three dogs, two French bulldogs and an English bulldog. So love the ability to be silly and to relax at the end of the day from that. I just try to, and I think at various points in our careers, we're either successful or or feel like we're not successful, but to sort of continuously ask the questions of myself, how am I spending my time? How are the priorities being addressed, both in personal life and professional life? That is something that I am deeply reflective on and something that I find very centering and grounding, especially in these challenging times that we're in, because the world as you describe it in 5 years and in that period isn't that way today, but there are elements there and we can work towards that.
Fabulous. Great. Thank you so much, Justin. Thank you very much for listening to today's podcast. We will include a summary of today's show and links about Dr. Klimarus and other references that were discussed in the show notes. I would like to conclude by sharing another practical exercise to help you flourish. Toward the end of the conversation, Dr. Klimarus mentioned his own mindfulness practice as a key to his own well-being and making it possible for him to continue to work with the challenges that he confronts daily, whether at work or at home. Today, I'd like to offer the following mindfulness practice to you that MPRO produced with me several years ago. It's about 3 minutes long, and we'll also make a video version available to you in the show notes that you can download and keep on your devices for future use. I suggest you use it to guide you weekly for the next several weeks, and then as often as you'd like to going forward. I would invite you to sit with me for a few minutes and engage in a very brief meditation practice that you can do at the beginning of your workday, at the end of your workday, in the middle of your workday, even right before you enter a patient's room. So as you sit, starting with an awareness of your physical body, your feet touching the floor, your legs, your thighs, your bottom touching the seat of the chair, your back against the back of the chair. Noticing how your arms are at your sides and noticing how you're resting your head upon your neck. You don't have to sit any particular way, but think of sitting in a way that wakes you up. And as you sit quietly, reflect for a few moments on what brought you into medicine as a profession. What drew you into medicine? What was the calling? It may be that it hasn't turned out quite exactly the way you planned, and that's okay. Reflecting for a few moments about what were those inklings, those feelings, those desires you had to attend to the care of others. When did you first notice that you were interested in working with life and befriending life, if you will? As you reflect on your sense of calling, and noticing how you can call on that sense of calling even now in the practice of medicine, right now in this moment, as you begin your day, as you end your day, as you encounter the next patient. Noticing how this feels in your body. Noticing the effects it has on you emotionally in terms of joy, satisfaction, meaning. Perhaps noticing how it engages your mental activities with a desire to do a good job, to work diligently, and also to enjoy yourself. Thank you for joining me, and I hope you'll try this once in a while and see how it works. I hope you have found this podcast and the simple exercise useful to you. and look forward to having you join me for the next episode of Flourishing in Medicine from Surviving to Thriving. To learn more about MPRO, please visit www.mympro.com and their peer support programs, www.mympro.com/peer-support. If you're a physician or a medical student and you need urgent support, consider calling the Physician Support Line at 1-888-409-0141 or visit www.physiciansupportline.com. For information about me and my work, feel free to visit www.mickkrasnermd.com or www.mindfulpracticeinmedicine.com. Until next time.